telling the truth is the only mandate we believe in. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the Mind Medicine Program in association with Mind Medicine Australia. I'm one of your co-hosts, Charles Coves, with Tanya de Jong. We alternate the hosting of the program. I am Australasia's passion provocateur. And every fortnight, you can find this program between 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Now, what's this show all about? And sorry for the delay. We've had some technical problems. Well, this show is about how and why your mind matters. Insights into mental health issues and health issues of all descriptions. So not just the mind, but anything else. Mind Medicine Australia, I'll tell you about that in a moment. Passion and its impact on your mental health and much more. And then each hour, I interview a guest. And let me tell you first about Mind Medicine Australia. This show is thrilled to support the mental health charity. Through this program, Mind Medicine Australia is Australia's leading not-for-profit organisation working on the use of medicinal psilocybin and MDMA-assisted therapies to treat a range of mental illnesses. Mind Medicine Australia exists to help alleviate the suffering caused by our accelerating mental illness epidemic in Australia through expanding the treatment options available to medical practitioners and their patients. Unlike current treatments such as antidepressants, which only manage the illness and can have nasty side effects, psilocybin and MDMA-assisted therapies have been scientifically proven to be a safe and effective cure for anxiety, depression, end-of-life stress, addictions, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Both medicines have been granted breakthrough therapy status by the FDA in the United States to fast-track their approval. Mind Medicine Australia is dedicated to helping the rapidly emerging global movement to spread awareness and ensure these medicines are available via the medical system. It's a crucial element in the way to treat mental health issues. And so we hope you take an interest and visit its website. I'll give you the details of that website later. Now, I'm thrilled to introduce to you our guest in the first hour today. A wonderful, wonderful man, Victor Perton. Now, before I ask him to say anything, he is the optimism man. And right in my hand now, I have his book, Optimism, The How and Why. Victor was elected member of the Victorian Parliament for 18 years. He's a leadership expert. He's written two books. His website is victorperton.com. He qualified as a barrister. He's an advocate. He's been retained by governments. He was the Victorian government representative in the US. I could go on and on again, but I'd rather have Victor talk about himself. Victor, welcome to the Mind Medicine Program.
Charles, it is such a delight to be with you. I'm actually bayside in a city called Geelong in Australia, overlooking the bay and people sailing and enjoying themselves. And it's a delight to join you. You've been a leader in the science of passion for over three decades. You are one of the leaders of Australia in a whole range of fields. And for me to be chatting to you today about mind and matter and leadership, it's just a joy. And I always think of the phrase when I think of you, optimism is a state of mind, not a state of the world. So no matter what's going on in the world, we can each make a difference, and you make a difference every day, Charles.
That's very kind of you, Victor. Thank you for that. And just so that you know, you spent a fair bit of time on the west coast of the US, and right there it's 6 p.m. Friday night. So hopefully people are listening to us, but they've also listened to a replay of this program. Yeah, they might be listening on the podcast, Victor, so we never know where they're listening to your powerful message on optimism. So explain to us what your current work is all about, and then we'll delve back into your amazing past.
Well, look, let's talk about the future rather than the past. So the history of why I spend every day asking people what makes you optimistic, whether it's a president or a prime minister or a woman digging a ditch in India. As you said, I was in Parliament for many years, and I retired from Parliament because I could just see the way politics in Australia as it has in the United States and England, has become increasingly negative. You know, it's not so much a game for positive players. It's a game for pessimists and negative people. So I left, and I then, as you said, worked across North and South America for 3 years, living in San Francisco, an office in New York, and everywhere I went, there was this incredible positive stereotype of Australians. The chairman of Caterpillar said to me, look, you Aussies remind me of the Americans of 100 years ago. Nothing is impossible. The truckie on Route 66 said, oh, I love that Foster's of yours. And then after that, I was even more fortunate to be senior advisor to the Australian G20 presidency. So the G20 is the organization of the 20 most powerful economies. And again, at that super elite level of presidents, prime ministers, finance ministers, there was this astonishing positivity around leadership. And then I got back to Australia and I was astonished just how negative had become. And rather than take too much time on the program, the science says it is so. There has been a dramatic diminution in optimism in four of your biggest listening countries. In Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada, and in the USA, which, you know, from its founding was a font of optimism. And the Australian statistics I know well, and because this is, you know, the MIND program, at the same time as personal optimism has plunged in Australia, we've had a doubling of the number of people who are medicated for depression and anxiety. And so, you know, what became clear to me was the problem wasn't a problem of leadership. The problem is a problem of pessimism, of negativity. And that's why my mother died last year at the age of 92, at, like yours, a refugee. And towards the end of her life, she said, Vic, there is no more important thing you've ever done in your life than try and stimulate people to think about what makes them optimistic. So not the grand speech from the podium, not the prime minister, not the economy. For most people, optimism is a state of mind, and it comes from life experience, mindset, family, faith, spirituality, meditation. And so I have great joy every day, Charles, asking people what makes them optimistic and sharing those answers. And just even in the last 2 days, you know, on Thursday night, I was with the Australian professionals of colour, asking them what makes them optimistic. Yesterday, I was with one of the most important Australian government agencies, and we had 50 of their staff members share, each of them, what makes them optimistic. And you can imagine how uplifting it was for an organisation that otherwise is in a very difficult period of change and transformation.
So, Victor, that's the work that you do is just wonderful. And what do you say to somebody? And you know, that is such a great question of what makes you optimistic. What advice do you have from all of the conversations, that you've had, to somebody who says, well, you know, I'm not optimistic? Just give us, you know, because listeners go, well, look, it's okay for Victor. You know, Victor's got this charmed, wonderful life. But I haven't, and I am not optimistic. What do you say to such people?
Well, first let's go back to the definition of optimism. So optimism is not la-di-da, you know, silver lining in every dark cloud. You know, we know bad stuff happens to people, and everyone has their share of grief. You know, we bury our parents. We may bury, you know, close friends and the like. So grief, sadness, these are parts of the human condition. Happiness comes and goes. Optimism, my favourite expression of optimism is actually 700 years old. And it comes from an English mystic, Mother Julian of Norwich. And, you know, she nearly died of disease. And while she was sick, she promised to dedicate herself to God should she survive. And she did. And her famous phrase, which has now found its way into poetry and song, is all shall be well. All shall be well, all manner of thing shall be well. Now, you know, the Black Plague killed 30% of the English population, and similar to that in the rest of Europe. And so if we move forward to the contemporary definition, which is used by Harvard and Oxford and the like, Mother Julian could have written it if she lived 700 years. And the modern definition of optimism is it's a belief that good things will happen and that things will work out in the end. And Charles, I don't know if you are you old enough to be a John Lennon fan?
I am definitely. In fact, I was 15 when Sergeant Pepper's was released in 1967.
Well, John Lennon famously added to that definition by saying, and if it hasn't worked out, it's not the end. So optimism is this notion of carrying on. So I've had people do it. There's one classic Rotary meeting that I was at, and, you know, Rotarians tend to be pretty optimistic people. So, you know, there were 25 people in the room and 24 of them had shared their optimism, and we got to the president and he looked at me and he said, I'm not an optimist, I'm a pessimist. And I said, yeah, but the question I'm asking is not are you an optimist or a pessimist? My question is what makes you optimistic? What makes you positive? And he thought for a minute and then he shared a couple of things. And then 2 weeks later, he rang me and he said, you know, I actually think I'm probably not a pessimist. I actually do think of the positive. Now, the science, I mean, I don't want to go on too long, but if you'd like to, I can.
Yeah,
I've got a couple of really good...
Because I want you
that my favourite definition of optimism came from a molecular psychiatrist, Professor G. And Professor G took 18 months to answer my question, what makes you optimistic? And her answer was... Optimism is the evidence of dreams not yet realized. Optimism is the evidence of dreams not yet realized. And everyone has dreams that are not yet realized. And so, and in fact, there's some other evidence around that molecular level that says that optimism and pessimism may actually come from different parts of the brain. So yeah. You can actually have someone who's optimistic, maybe in their personal facets of life, but pessimistic at work. And classically, the commercial lawyer or the procurement manager tends to be personally optimistic. So you run into them and, you know, how are you, Bob? And, you know, Bob says, oh, everything's good and, you know, fit and the kids are great. And but then you talk to them about, you know, their customers or their suppliers or, you know, the lawyer writes a 500-page contract on everything that could go wrong in a business deal, even though less than 0.1% of contracts ever even go to mediation. And so you can actually have the person who's personally optimistic but pessimistic about work, or you can actually have people who are personally pessimistic yet optimistic about work. So it's quite... You know, everyone has the potential to increase their optimism just by dreaming a little bit more and letting their dreams influence their future.
Well, let me take your definition, not the Mother Julian, although I love that because I run another program each week, and one of the mantras is "This too will pass," which is a variation on "All shall be well." So even if you're going through lousy times, this too will pass because nothing stays the same forever. So coming to this evidence of dreams not yet realized as the definition of optimism, and then I'll share with you my favorite definition of success. That, and I learned this from Earl Nightingale, where he shared this in the 1950s, and it's the best definition of success that I have found. It says that success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. And then optimism is the evidence of dreams not yet realized. And so this question that, see, most people think they're only successful if they have achieved their worthy ideal or their dream. And the problem with that is that if that is what success is, then as soon as you've achieved some worthy ideal, then you've got to go on to the next one. And so life is like climbing mountains. You climb the mountain. The problem is you get to the top of the mountain, then you've got to go down into the depths again. So if the only time where feeling successful is when we're at that moment in time. That's a very short period of time in our lives. So that definition of success ties in beautifully with that your favorite definition of optimism, of the dreams not yet realized. And therefore, people feel successful on a moment-by-moment basis. I suppose that helps them be optimistic.
Well, it's like joy and happiness. You see, they come and go. And the lovely thing about the trait of optimism is that it actually becomes stronger the older you get. So the lovely thing about contemporary times is, you know, people are now in Australia. You know, the average male lives to 84. The average female lives to 88. So we actually go well beyond that career period for most people. I mean, my mother was still working at 92. I can imagine, Charles, you'll be still working like my friend John Hagel at the age of 120. Right?
So,
but it was interesting yesterday, you know, with that government agency, because some of the people are a bit older. And, you know, two or three of the men and women reflected the extent to which their contemporary optimism is influenced by their grandchildren. You know, Catherine Misson, who you would have met, you know, one of the most famous Australian educators, when I asked her what makes her optimistic, she said, looking at life through the eyes of a child. So beautiful. Optimism is not just a work-related thing. You know, you can see, you know, as you're getting older and your children are, I don't know if you're a grandfather yet, are you?
I am, yes, two granddaughters.
Well, you know, I mean, you can describe to your listeners, you know, the emotion of picking up those grandchildren, of introducing them to things they're curious about. And John Hagel, who's on our board, you know, the famous head of the Deloitte Centre for the Edge, you know, wrote a book this last year called The Journey Beyond Fear. And he talks about one of the foundations of optimism being the passion of the explorer. Now, you are the expert on passion. You, Charles, are constantly exploring new questions and new curiosities. But just imagine the 3-year-old or the 5-year-old for whom everything is new, for a grandfather to introduce that child to the world that they know and understand fills them with a renewed optimism. And there's a lovely study from Israel, quite recent, which says that even at the age of 85, the life expectancy difference between an optimist and a pessimist is huge, because the pessimist basically thinks life isn't worth living anymore and they will die.
Yes.
The optimist says, I've still got stuff to live for. And I love the people in their 80s and 90s who answer the question to me and say, my best days are still ahead of me.
That's certainly how I think. I'm 69, Victor, so people would have worked that out from what I shared with you. And quite frankly, I am planning to live till I'm at least 120, but I am open to the possibility that I'll die tomorrow. So it's not as if I assume I'm going to live till 120. I'm planning to live till I'm 120, and that therefore means that I don't have this mindset that says, oh, I'm too old to do this. No, I've got another 50 years of work ahead of me.
And look, the really interesting contemporary work, I mean, you and Tanya are very much involved in very contemporary medical research. The work that's been done in Harvard, University of Michigan, Oxford, Vienna Medical School over the last 2 years, the research shows that the strongest trait associated with healthy longevity, living beyond 85 in good physical and mental health, is not genetics, it's not geography, it's not wealth, it's not income. It's actually the trait of optimism. And the American Heart Association, you know, which represents the heart surgeons, the cardiologists of America, they have now declared in a scientific statement that positive emotions, and they use the word optimism, is the most protective trait against heart attack and angina, and most predictive that someone will recover from heart disease. And, you know, I've been doing some workshops with Epworth Hospital in Melbourne and other medical groups, you know, helping the practitioners become more optimistic themselves, but also giving them some of the hints and tips that they can give their patients to help their patients become more optimistic and therefore more likely to recover from the conditions for which they're being treated.
So, Victor, tell us about these workshops, because it's good that you mentioned that, because you run workshops on optimism. How does that work, and what type of groups do you run workshops for? How does that work?
Well, I've done everything from criminals in jail to school children to the British government and wealth companies and the like. So typically a workshop that's run by me, we'll have a jovial beginning. Then I'll define optimism as we did earlier in response to your second question. Then I talk about the science of optimism, you know, this longevity question, you know, why it's healthy for you. I then talk about the world of work, you know, why optimism is central to 2020's leadership, strategy, innovation, change, resilience. And then I share the habits of optimism. And some of them, you know, if your listeners just want to take one or two suggestions away, they may. And then what I love doing, depending on how much time we've got is just going around the room, asking everyone in the room to share what makes them optimistic. And yeah, we always try and prepare them beforehand because I don't want to, you know, surprise someone. I like them to think about it. But it brings such a joy, you know, whether it is a university, whether it is even in prison. The lovely thing was, after we'd done three sessions in prison, we were then asked to do a workshop for the managers of prisons. And I tell you what we did with the prisoners. What we did with the prisoners, that we said to them, there's a question in greetings in Australia and Ireland and France where you typically say, g'day, how are you? Or hello, how are you? It's the same in Irish, it's the same in French. And the typical answer, 65% of people answer, not bad or not too bad. And we never say, oh, my God, what's wrong? We actually just ignore it. And so there's a wasted question and a wasted answer there. So what I got the prisoners to do was to get rid of the how are you and to say, hello, oh, well, what's been the best thing in your day so far? Now, of course, in prison, if a 5-times murderer looks you in the eye and says, what's been the best thing in your day? You can imagine a warder's going to answer that question. But, you know, I did a radio interview in New Zealand recently, and the announcer opened the interview by saying, I've been plagiarising this man for the last year. And, of course, that's what he'd been doing. He'd got rid of the question, how are you? And everyone knew that when he met them and greeted them, they would be asked for a question, a story of hope and optimism. And look, you know, people, the practical, the other day I was in the supermarket and I have a yellow mask which says, what makes you optimistic? And the checkout lady said, look, what do you do? And I told her what I did. And I said, look, why don't you try this experiment for a week? And she looked a bit doubtful. And so I turned around and behind me there was a girl about 10 and her mum. And I said, look, we're just trying an experiment. Can I ask you what's been the best thing in your day? And the little girl answered immediately. She said, oh, I got 82 for my test. Well, she lit up. The mum lit up. The four people behind them lit up. The people in the neighbouring queues lit up. And I said to her, well, what was the test? And she said, maths. And again, so just this one little girl answering the question, you know, made everyone happy. So what you will find, if your listeners try this today or tomorrow, hello, what's been the best thing in your day? Whatever comes natural to you. Maybe on a Monday you'll say, what was the best thing on your weekend? Or maybe on a Friday you might say, what was the best thing in your week? 80% of people will share a positive story with you. And then they'll look at you and say, what was the best thing in your day? And, of course, you'll share a story with them. And it is so uplifting. Everyone who's undertaken it, 100% of people who've reported back to me on it, say it's changed their lives.
So Victor, I'm willing to share with our listeners a list of such types of questions. I've got a list of 20 different questions to ask rather than how are you. So if any of you would like a copy of that, please send us an email. I'll be happy to share that. And there are, and I'm sure, Victor, you've got a list of those, but we won't go into that for the moment because I'm really interested. Once you've done a workshop, don't go to prison because that's quite unusual, but in a workplace, when you do your workshop, half a day or a day, what then follows? Just give us a taste of, wow, we would love to transform our workplace in that way, because it's great to do the workshop, but then stuff has to change as a consequence of the workshop.
Yeah, I did. And so you don't want a sugar hit. You know, the danger of these things is they're a sugar hit. You know, they make someone feel good for the night. So we have a whole series. Number one, we've got a wonderful free course. If everyone wants to Google it, it's called The Habits of an Optimist. And it's animated and it's free. It takes between 50 minutes and a lifetime. And you get a certificate at the end. And it takes you through, in a lot of fun, what the habits are. We also suggest to people that they do things like keep a gratitude journal. I know you've kept one, Charles. Yes. And the principle is, look, just have a piece of paper or a pad by your bedside, and at the end of the day, write down the three best things in the day. And it doesn't need to be, you know, changing the world. It can be a nice cup of tea with a friend. And one of the lovely things, if you've got a partner or husband or wife or the like in bed with you, you can always say, oh, honey, I've just writing my gratitude journal. Do you want to share something that you're grateful for? So it's a great thing for strengthening the optimism of the person next to you. And we've of course, got a beautiful version of this. If anyone wants to Google it, again, it's Project Optimism Gratitude Journal for 100 days. There's a quote in ours. But the trick with it is, not a sugar hit to write it in the evening. In the morning, don't wake up to the news, right? Set your clock alarm to music or a bell or whatever. Because the first stimulus you want in the morning is to reread your gratitude from last night. So whether you're sitting on the toilet or whether you're having a cup of tea or coffee, you want to reread it. And I don't know, I'm not a particular fan of horror movies, but are you a fan of Stephen King, Charles?
I'm not a fan of horror movies because I reckon life is challenging enough as it is without putting myself through regular horror. But I am an admirer of Stephen King because The Green Mile is an amazing, I think the only movie of his that I've seen, his book that's been turned into a movie.
Well, Stephen King, you know, even though he spends 4 hours a day writing, you know, stuff to frighten us, before he gets out of bed, he spends 5 minutes meditating on what he's grateful for. So what we do, what we really try and do to people is get them to adopt habits. We start, you know, when I go through the habits, the simplest one is the one that the Dalai Lama recommends, which is smile and say hello to everyone.
Yes.
Right? You're walking down the street, you're walking down the corridor, you're in a cafe, sit near the door and say hello to everyone. And, I had a lovely interview with an artist who lives in Sydney in King's Cross. And he's our age, Charles, but 5 years ago, he was nearly dead of drug addiction and nasty stuff, methamphetamine and the like. He was lucky enough to get himself into a course to clean himself up. And he's walking through King's Cross and everyone's sort of smiling at him. You know, being a typical man, he's trying to work out whether, you know, in Australia we call it a fly, in America you might call it a zip, but whether his fly's undone or whether he's got spaghetti on his shirt. And what he realized was that in recovering from his drug addiction, he was smiling. And as he smiled, people assumed they were smiling at him. And so that became part of his ritual, that everyone you walk past, doesn't matter if they've got earbuds in their ears, it doesn't matter if they're looking at their screen, give them a smile and say hello, and you will be amazed at how healthy that is for you and for them. The other one is the one that comes from Bishop Tutu, you know, who died a few weeks ago. Bishop Tutu said, God commands us to laugh. And you remember all the speeches that Bishop Tutu used to do, even when he was running the Reconciliation Commission? He would laugh after every second sentence.
Yes.
If anyone wants some homework, watch the Dalai Lama talking. He laughs every sentence or every few sentences. And so just laugh more. And if you focus on that, and you and I could even do it at the end of this radio show if you like. We could do 30 seconds of laughter yoga if you want, Charles. I'm not sure if it works on the radio, but it certainly works in our group sessions.
Yeah, look, we will do some laughter yoga because I think that's before we finish it. You know, at 5:02 on the hour, we're going to do some laughter yoga, Victor, because I think doing that practice, and listeners, we expect you to go along with what the exercise is when Victor explains it. I have done it with Victor live. I'm sure it'll work on radio. Now, Victor, Tell us about your mum and where she came from and who, and you know, what you told me about your mother was she enjoyed life. Well, give us a snapshot of her.
Well, she was born in Latvia and went, you know, living a... Her father had gone through tough times in the Depression, but then had his business was thriving and they were living, you know, very well, you know, in the 1930s in Latvia, which was then an independent country. And then, you know, at the age of 12, she was out in the country and all of a sudden there was this column of tanks, you know, with guys with strange helmets, and it was the Soviet invasion of Latvia. And, you know, the farmers that she was on the farm with rushed her home to her parents, and, well, they were on the death list. And they were lucky enough that someone in the know told them that if they didn't leave Latvia, they were going to be on a train to Siberia and probably die. And so they were lucky enough, with one suitcase each, they left Latvia. And, you know, there were all sorts of adventures after that. You know, she could have died at the age of 12. She could have died when the Soviets nearly recaptured her at 16. She could have died when the Americans shot at her by accident at age 17. You know, then they were lucky enough to get to Australia. She met my father and, you know, they decided to go as far away from the Soviet Union as possible into a land of free speech and freedom. And my mother still tells, oh, well, she's died now, but she used to say, you know, having lived under Hitler and having lived under Stalin, she said, the lovely thing about Australia is you could say bloody Menzies and no one would lock you up. Menzies was then the prime minister, the equivalent of president in Australia in the 1950s. And then my father died when I was pretty young. So mum, like so many refo women, you know, who were left on their own, worked three jobs. And then through almost God-given circumstances, she found yoga. And she was very good at yoga, and she was magnetic in her personality. And some teenagers asked her whether she would teach them yoga. And then the mothers asked whether she would teach them yoga. And then the tax commissioner asked if she would teach the tax officials yoga. And then the Assumption Institute, the leading institute for Catholic nuns, asked if she'd teach yoga. And so, of course, you know, her fame spread, but she never sought fame. All she wanted to do was to teach people yoga. And she, you know, as I said, even though she could have been killed three times in her teenage years, she lived to the age of 92, and she kept teaching. And I was quite surprised because she died with pancreatic cancer. Her students told me she actually ran some classes for them 3 months before she died. And she was inspiring to them then, as she was. And you know, 2 weeks before she died, she said to me, you know, Victor, you've done so many important jobs. You've been, you know, as a mother does, you know, you've been a barrister, a politician, a trade commissioner. She said, but you've never done anything more important than helping people uncover their own optimism. And see, that's why I say, you know, it's not grand speeches. It's not prime ministers. It's not the economy. I was sitting in Circular Quay, which is a, you know, beautiful part of Sydney, you know, with a view of the bridge. And I was sitting in a cafe. It was 6 a.m. and there was one other bloke on the table next to me. And of course, those who know me, you know, some poor man or woman sitting on their own on the table next to me will never be on their own for long. And we got talking, and he was a Singapore businessman. And he shared with me, he said, look, oh, you know, I give my staff a rev up talk every Monday morning, and by Monday afternoon it's worn off.
Yeah.
And I said to him, did you ever ask them what makes them optimistic? Well, he actually did it and rang me 2 weeks later and said, from now on we're going to do it every month. And they have continued it every month. And there's a bit of homework for your listeners, Charles, because I know you've got board members and CEOs and chairs who listen to this. Oftentimes in a board meeting or executive meeting, people ask this question, what keeps you awake at night? Well, I'm a typical man, Charles. When my head hits the pillow, I'm knocked out. I'm asleep.
Yeah.
So I always, I've got nothing to say in those meetings. I just say nothing keeps me awake at night. But I always say to the chair or the CEO, why don't you try this every 3 months or every 6 months? Start the meeting with what makes you optimistic. And there's a very distinguished Australian businessman, Gonski, who headed up an education review. He headed up our biggest bank. He said, when you look at Australian corporate life, boards spend too much time on negative risk and not enough time on opportunity. And if people want to take home a bit of homework, if you're running a company, if you're on the board, if you're working for a company, go and have a look at your risk register. And given that risk is both positive and negative, right? It can be bad stuff or good stuff. Does your risk register include positivity? Because the World Economic Forum, which met 2 weeks ago in Davos, in its 2022 global risks, do you know what number four risk was, Charles?
No, I do not. I haven't heard.
The loss of optimism. The loss of optimism. So the global elites have now worked out that all of this doom and gloom and scaring people stiff every day of the week, whether it's COVID or climate or the like, is making people sick. It's diminishing their optimism and therefore diminishing entrepreneurship, innovation, and resilience.
Wow. Okay. I've taken a note of that. That is most instructive, and at least it's showing the understanding of some of these leaders of what you are talking about. Now, come back to this question of yoga, Victor. Your mum, what a great story that is. What are the benefits of being a yoga practitioner?
Oh, well, obviously good health, good mental and physical health, because it's a discipline. You start off by breathing, and we'll do that when we do our laughter. We're not just going to break into laughter. We're going to get people to breathe first. So number one is controlling the breath in a way that is calming. And oftentimes, there are people, I had a lovely woman, Daddy Janki, who ran a religious organization called the Brahma Kumaris. And she lived to 103, Charles, and still ran the organization to 102.
Yes, and yes, I've done some programs with the Brahma Kumaris, Victor. They're a wonderful, wonderful organization.
Well, very positive and optimistic. And when I first met her in the 1990s, she said to me, she said, "You must be very busy as a politician." I said, yes, I am. She said, "Why don't you try this? Instead of sitting down for 20 minutes of meditation, why don't you just try 1 minute an hour?" Right? A 1 minute meditation. And people have got Apple Watches. There's actually an app on an Apple Watch now that can remind you every hour to take 1 minute to think 1 minute to breathe. So breathing is the heart of yoga, controlling your breath. And then it's postures of control, whether it's, bending your back forward or back, or just movement, moving your limbs in controlled ways. And I always like Prime Minister Modi, in India, who took it to the United Nations and had the United Nations declare yoga as part of the world's heritage. And there's an International Day of Yoga. So yoga, as I said, it improves your health, it improves your self-control, and most of all, it makes you happier and more optimistic. And most people walk out of a yoga class sort of walking on air.
Before we do that. The question, we've been talking about health, and this show is about health, and I want to share with you, Victor, and our listeners, and I'm going to do this quite regularly, about what it actually means to be healthy. And I say that the medical profession generally does not have a definition of health. For most people, being healthy is the absence of obvious disease. And the Hungarian word, the Hungarian language is very precise. And the word for health in Hungarian is egészség, which literally means wholeness, being whole. And so my definition of health for listeners to contemplate, but yoga, it strikes me as a real way to get into this, is that health is the unique optimal balance for you of mental, physical, and spiritual elements.
Oh, you have nailed it, Charles. I mean, spirituality, whether people believe in God or just meditate to come to grips with some higher force than themselves, You've nailed it. It's that combination.
So everybody, please think about how well you are balanced mentally, physically, spiritually. Now, Victor, we've got another 4 or 5 minutes. Let's get into this yoga exercise, this laughter exercise to help people. So over to you.
All right, but everyone.
And before you do, can you explain to people why there's a little bit of background wind noise where you are?
Oh, I'm going to hide behind a tree again. I'm sitting in a city called Geelong, which is on the southeast coast of Australia, I'm overlooking the bayside with children playing and people picnicking, and obviously there are motorcyclists who are enjoying themselves driving on the road behind me. So I've put myself behind a tree again so the wind noise is a little bit less, but it's probably quite good for breathing. So what we're going to do for this is 30 seconds of laughter. So you've got to get rid of all your inhibitions, folks. Imagine you are going to be laughing into the speaker of the radio or your computer, wherever you're listening to this, and we're going to breathe in 3 times just to get ourselves under control, and then Charles and I are going to start laughing, and we hope that you're going to laugh along with us. So breathe in to the count of 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Oh, no, I'm starting to cough, Charles. I think that's 25 seconds. That's enough. So, look, everyone, if you want to do that once a day, it's just a wonderful thing to do. Some people actually have laughter clubs and laughter yoga, but the most important thing is you do what Bishop Tutu did or the Dalai Lama does. Make sure you just laugh a little bit when someone says something funny.
Beautiful, Victor. Now, I read a piece that also said if you feel like you're having a heart attack, then strong laughter is a way that you can help to massage your hearts, everybody. So I will dig that out, because I could feel as I was laughing then what a physical impact it has on me, as well as mental and spiritual. So excellent reminder, Victor. Now, last question for you. We've got one more minute. I want you to think about a book that has had a big impact on you over the last few years. You know, I know your book.
The book of the 2010s was John Hagel. So John, H-E-G-E-L, The Power of Pull, P-U-L-L. A brilliant book about, you know, how we're all buried in data and messaging, and how you can draw people towards you with your ideas and your vision. And then I think for the 2020s, it's a book by a Swedish professor who died while he was writing the book, called Factfulness. And it just describes how most people, informed people who listen to the news, are completely misinformed about the state of the world. The state of the world is so much better than what you get by listening to broadcast news on television or radio. And Factfulness by Dr. Rosling.
Hans Rosling.
R-O-S-L-I-N-G.
Yeah.
Those are my two favourite books of the last 12 years.
Murray, The Power of Pull, everybody, by John Hagel. And Factfulness by Hans Rosling. In fact, it was finished by his daughter, I think. And what struck me from that book, Victor, is that in 13 multiple choice questions about the state of the world, that the average score was 3 out of 13, and that was for professors and PhDs and highly educated people. So you're quite right. Most people are not aware of how great this world is. So, Victor, thank you for your wonderful contribution, for your wonderful ongoing work in making this world more optimistic. Thank you for being on the Mind Medicine program. Go and enjoy the rowing that you're there to watch in Geelong, and I look forward to further conversations with you. Have a beautiful weekend.
Thank you, Charles, and keep up your wonderful work of passion and leadership, bringing us to, as you say in Hungarian, a whole health.
Beautiful. Thank you, Victor. Bye-bye. Bye for now.
Thanks, Charles.
So, ladies and gentlemen, lovely to have Victor Perton, former parliamentarian, on the show with us on Mind Medicine Program. I'm Charles Coves, Australasia's passion provocateur. And my definition of passion for you, as we come up to the top of the hour, is that passion is a source of unlimited energy from your soul, your spirit, your heart, that enables you to produce extraordinary results. And you think about your ability to get anything done is all about energy. And so I urge you, as you listen to this program, to constantly be looking for what you are passionate about. And when you are pursuing that, as Victor Perton said, when you have a big dream, when you're living your passion, you will be optimistic. And that will be the evidence of dreams not yet realized. I look forward to being with you in the second hour. Stick around for Mind Medicine on TNT Radio.